The headlines: the number of Palestinians killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza since Tuesday rises to 25 as Palestinians fire a barrage of rockets toward Israel in response. Political tensions are rising in Pakistan as authorities arrest another close ally of former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who was detained this week. And Russia says it has achieved certain goals in its special military operation in Ukraine and has severely damaged the Ukrainian military machine. Hello and welcome, everybody. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military arm of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, has confirmed the killing of three of its commanders in a late-night Israeli attack on Gaza. Head of Islamic Jihad's rocket-launching force, identified as Ali Ghali, and two other commanders died in the regime's airstrikes on Khan Yunis in the southern part of the coastal strip. 12 people were also injured. This is the third day of Israeli aggression on Gaza. Over two dozen Palestinians have been killed so far, including several senior members of the Islamic Jihad movement, along with their family members. Palestinians have fired barrages of rockets on the occupied territories in response to the regime's assaults. The Israeli military claims that it has intercepted the rockets, but local media reported that a building was hit in the town of Sderot. Our Gaza correspondent, Asher Shannon, earlier gave us the latest on Israel's deadly aggression against the besieged Palestinian territory.
Over the last few years, Israel has been increasing its attacks against Palestinians in Gaza, claiming the lives of dozens of Palestinians. Israel has launched some 150 airstrikes since Tuesday, while according to the Israeli regime, Palestinian factions have fired over 480 rockets towards the occupied territories. What has been very clear during this round of Israeli escalation is that the Palestinian resistance groups have increased their strength, especially the use of rockets, as Israel has for the first time utilized its rocket interception system called David Sling for the first time to down rockets that were fired from Gaza towards Tel Aviv.
A young Palestinian man has succumbed to wounds he sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank, according to Palestinian medical sources. Aus Amin Hamamda was wounded when the regime's forces stormed the town of Rabatiya, south of Jenin. The town has witnessed repeated Israeli assaults. On Wednesday, Israeli troops raided the town again and opened fire on locals, including on a vehicle that left two Palestinians dead and another wounded. They also broke into the homes and destroyed people's property. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year. In Pakistan, authorities have detained a close aide of former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who himself was arrested this week over a corruption case. Shah Mahmood Qureshi, who served as foreign minister under Khan's premiership, was detained amid growing political unrest across the country. In a statement, the Tehreek-e-Insaf party announced that Qureshi was taken to an undisclosed location. Earlier, two other senior leaders of the party, Asad Omar and Fawad Chaudhry, were arrested. Nationwide protests sparked after Khan was taken into custody. There were violent clashes between his supporters and police in several cities. The government has already given its approval to deploy troops to Punjab and Islamabad to restore peace. On Wednesday, cricketer-turned-politician Khan was remanded in police custody for 8 days.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was assisted by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery.
I might have been arrested in a false case when this message reaches all of you. The fundamental rights and democracy have been vanished from the country. Whatever happening at the moment is because of this imported government. So it's time for all of you to take to the streets for real freedom of the country.
The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law, as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife's name. The money should have been deposited in the National Treasury, but went into a property which was registered under a trust.
Following the arrest, thousands of Khan's supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to protest their leader's detention. Clashes between police and protesters were also reported in all major cities and towns of the country.
The arrest of the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The European Union's foreign policy towards Africa is slated as the humanitarian situation in Sudan deteriorates. There have been calls in the European Parliament for the bloc to provide asylum to Sudanese refugees amid heavy clashes between rival military forces. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize a de facto military dictatorship because this is the arrangement that has served our financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticised for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda. I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia says it has achieved certain goals in its special military operation in Ukraine, stressing that the operation will continue. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia has severely damaged the Ukrainian military machine. He, however, admitted that the operation in Ukraine is very difficult. Peskov said Ukraine's continued shelling of eastern parts of the country taken by Russia demonstrates the need to continue the operation to push back pro-Kiev forces. He added that Russia has launched countless missile strikes against military targets across Ukraine. Ukraine accuses Russia of hitting civilian targets, an accusation that Moscow denies. Following a quadrilateral meeting in Moscow, foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria, and Turkey have agreed to prepare a roadmap aimed to promote the relations between Damascus and Ankara. Marina Kortanova brings us more on that.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of the permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the UN. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the UN humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same UN to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
U.S. President Joe Biden has renewed his call on Congress to ban access to assault weapons in the country. That in the wake of a mass shooting in Texas that claimed 8 lives. Based on reports, some 15,000 Americans have lost their lives to gun violence so far this year, and this trend is probably going to continue.
The gun violence nightmare continues in the U.S. 8 people were shot and several others wounded by a gunman at a busy mall north of Dallas, Texas. The gunman, whom authorities said they believe acted alone, was killed by a police officer after he began firing outside of the mall. He was wearing tactical gear and carrying an AR-15-style rifle during the attack. One young eyewitness described the horrifying moments as the shooting unfolded, including the terrifying sounds of the gunfire, and she remains fearful that such an attack could reoccur.
When I heard it, it was like really loud. It kept going like, and what my dad heard, it was like a pling in a car. And then when we were running, the shot got closer to us, like really, really close. And I thought they were running towards us since we were all running around and there were more people running around us. I felt really scared because many people were running for their lives and some people didn't survive. Some got injured. I'm still feeling scared because it could happen to us at school. It could happen to us at another mall.
Reports say the social media accounts of the shooter contained hundreds of posts with racially or ethnically motivated content and violent far-right rhetoric. The reports say the Dallas attacker may have been linked to white supremacist or neo-Nazi groups. Texas Governor Greg Abbott called the shooting an unspeakable tragedy.
Texans are hurting today, and the people who are hurting the most, obviously, are the families of the victims, families who've lost a loved one, families who have a loved one who is injured.
Abbott also said there has been a dramatic increase in the amount of anger and violence that's taking place in America. He said mental health problems are the root cause and should be answered. Mass shootings have become commonplace in the United States. Since the beginning of 2023, more than 200 mass shootings have taken place in the country. Credible estimates show that nearly 15,000 people have died this year in gun violence incidents.
In the wake of a mass shooting in Texas, U.S. President Reuters called for a national assault weapons ban and other gun safety measures. However, this isn't the first time Biden is urging stricter gun laws. In fact, he has signed more than a dozen executive orders to deal with the issue, but the crisis doesn't seem to be easing.
In the wake of yet another mass shooting, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to pass gun control bills.
Yesterday, an assailant in tactical gear armed with an AR-15-style assault weapon gunned down innocent people in a shopping mall, and not for the first time. Such an attack is too shocking to be so familiar. We need more action, faster, to save lives.
The Democratic president renewed calls for Congress to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, as well as to enact universal background checks and end immunity for gun manufacturers. Biden, who has made similar pleas before, said members of Congress cannot continue to meet the gun violence epidemic with a shrug. However, there is little chance the narrowly divided House and Senate would pass such legislation, although polls show most Americans support background checks. The U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms, and that issue is a hot-button one for many Republicans who are backed by millions in donations from gun rights groups and manufacturers.
We are not anti-gun. We're not against the Second Amendment. You know, we believe that we must restore the responsibilities that go along with gun rights. There are other peer nations, high-income countries, that have high rates of gun ownership but low rates of gun violence. Those two things can coexist. What we have that no peer nation has is this wealthy, powerful special interest that's been allowed to write our nation's gun laws.
Firearms outnumber the population in the United States, where victims of gun violence are higher than any developed country.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من
این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب
In the limelight.
The British government is accused of unashamed racism in refugee policy. Immigration experts believe differing responses to refugees from Sudan and Ukraine are linked to the color of their skin. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Al Mayadeen, the UK Refugee Council suggests that family reunion applications from Sudanese nationals should be expedited, and that the UK should reflect on its colonial history with Sudan and support aiding the refugees. In light of the ongoing conflict in Sudan, as thousands flee the country in search of refuge, the UK Home Office has been accused of an unashamedly racist refugee system, as it refuses to allow Sudanese refugees from entering the UK for shelter, but goes above and beyond for the Ukrainians. A lack of choices for those fleeing Sudan sheds light on the behavior of the UK government towards them, especially seen with the final evacuation flight from Sudan to the UK recently. Almost 300,000 visas have been issued for Ukrainians so far to depart Ukraine amid the crisis, including 193,900 for the UK's Homes Sponsorship Scheme, launched in March 2022. ¥94,000 Ukrainians were granted a family scheme that allows them to join relatives in the UK. Immigration experts, however, believe the skin color of the refugees seems to play a quiet, significant role in the different approaches. Policy and Advocacy Manager for the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, JCWI, Caitlin Boswell said, "The racism of the UK's immigration system couldn't be more clear, with this government drawing policies affecting people seeking safety along stark racial lines. At the same time, ministers are using unashamedly inflammatory and far-right language, whipping up hatred towards black and brown migrants. In the meantime, RT noted, the British government has been accused of operating an unashamedly racist refugee system by denying safe and legal passage to people escaping conflict in Sudan, while providing those options for those fleeing Ukraine, immigration experts told The Guardian. The blatant refusal to provide a level of sanctuary and safety for Sudanese refugees in comparison to white Ukrainians has firmly exposed the unashamedly racist thinking at the heart of immigration legislation. Fitzi Qureshi, chief executive of the Migrants' Rights Network, told the British outlet Guardian recently. She accused the Home Office of Britain of having created a segregated refugee system. UK Foreign Secretary James Cleverly said London had coordinated the longest and largest evacuation of any Western country after the final flight from Port Sudan departed on May 3rd. More than 2,450 people were reportedly evacuated on 30 flights, the majority of whom were British nationals and their dependents. The UK also announced it would provide an initial £5 million, $6.3 million of life-saving aid to help meet the urgent needs of those fleeing the violence. However, The Guardian noted that no safe and legal routes have been made available to help Sudanese refugees flee, and there is no sign of any new scheme to deal with the fallout of the conflict. Meanwhile, the report said nearly 300,000 visas had been issued to Ukrainian refugees, including 193,900 under Home Sponsorship Scheme, which began in March 2022, and 94,900 for a family program that allows them to reunite with family members already living in the UK. Caitlin Boswell, Policy and Advocacy Manager for the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, told The Guardian that the government develops policies affecting those seeking safety along stark racial lines. Raga Ahmad of the Sudanese Community and Information Centre in London also claimed that people from his country are treated differently to Ukrainians, adding that color and race should not matter when there is a crisis. In response to the allegations, a UK government spokesperson said it was wrong to compare and set vulnerable groups against each other, and insisted that preventing a humanitarian crisis in Sudan was a priority. Last month, the Refugee Council said the UK Home Office had the power to help more, but had failed to do so. It had significant discretion it can use to grant visas, particularly in response to exceptional circumstances, but has decided not to, said the council's chief executive, Enver Solomon. He added that there was a need to prioritize safe routes for refugees in the same way that was done for Ukrainians last year.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has carried out a series of strikes on Gaza, killing at least 13 people, including four children. Three members of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement and their families were also among those killed. The Ministry of Health says at least 20 others were also injured in the pre-dawn strikes. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have also intensified their crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the reasons behind this escalation. We have with us Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joining us live from Beirut. Also, Chris Williamson, host of Palestine Declassified, joining us from Derby, from the UK. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of Spotlight. Let's begin with Laith Maarouf. We have received different reactions from resistance groups, of course, all of them vowing to retaliate. Do you think that we could actually expect a united retaliation as it has been discussed? What kind of retaliation would that entail?
Well, we've heard statements by all the resistance groups in Palestine saying that they will be retaliating. So now we know at least inside Palestine there is a unified front. Much of Israel right now, at least the what is called the Gaza envelope, has been either evacuated or under lockdown. The schools are closed in the Zionist colony tomorrow. So what we should be expecting is the same as the Zionists are expecting. The Zionists are expecting a heavy blow as a response to this treacherous assassination of Islamic Jihad leadership in Gaza, that it will be something that will be felt across Israel. There's even the bunkers in Tel Aviv have been opened right now. So this gives us a hint where we're going.
Okay, now before we discuss how Israel will react to that, let's bring in Chris Williamson. Mr. Williamson, how united do you see the resistance front in Palestine? We do know that the Achilles heel for any resistance would be to not be united in their fight for whatever the cause there is. And, of course, the divide and rule policy is something that has proven to work. The name of the game here would be solidarity and unification. And how much do you see that among different Palestinian factions and resistance groups?
Well, first of all, let me say that this is yet another brutal response by the Israeli regime. And, you know, it's a time for the international community to stand up and to speak out against, I mean, you know, this continuation of turning a blind eye is totally unacceptable. But in terms of the resistance, you know, from what I've understand the situation to be from the various programs that we put on Palestine Declassified, we know that there's unprecedented unity now across Palestine in terms of the resistance, the kind of axis of resistance as it's known, right across all the different factions. So, you know, one of the things which I think, you know, the Israelis are finding difficult to come to terms with is the effectiveness now of the resistance and the ability of the resistance to strike back. And I think we will certainly see a response from the resistance to this latest brutal atrocity by the Zionist entity.
Okay, so Mr. Maarouf, in your opinion, why does the Israelis attack, when they attack these targets, why don't they consider that there might be women and children there? Is this something that they do on purpose? They want to have women and children killed as well? Or is this some kind of collateral damage?
You know, the Zionists are brutal ghouls. They are blood hungry. They talk about our peoples in our region as if they're tribal. But in reality, if you see how they purposefully target the family and children of leadership in Palestine, meaning that they want to cut off the bloodline of a family, that is the most tribal and most vicious thing you can do. Also, it is important to note that these three leadership of Palestinian Islamic Jihad were on their way to Egypt. They were invited by the Egyptian negotiators who are mediating between the Zionist colony and Palestinian groups in Gaza on the release of an exchange of prisoners. They were invited by the Egyptian government to arrive in Egypt today. And they were supposed to leave the Gaza border at 9 o'clock in the morning, meaning the Zionists knew where that they will be doing so. And the Zionists saw that they are gone to see their families, to say goodbye to them before they go to Egypt, and they took advantage of that and assassinated them. So this is as vicious as the assassination of General Soleimani, who also was arriving to Baghdad on invitation of for negotiations of peace. So this is what the Zionists do. And finally, one last thing to say here is one of the civilians that were killed, other than the children and women, was the general chief of Al-Wafa Hospital, a very famous doctor in Gaza who headed at one point the Dentist Association. And he's a dual citizen, a Russian-Palestinian citizen. This was a very, very vicious attack, and it will receive a response very soon from the Palestinian resistance groups.
So, Mr. Williamson, Netanyahu has just said that they are prepared for any kind of scenario. On the other hand, we do know that Tel Aviv is now warning settlers living near the Gaza Strip to stay close to bomb shelters in the coming hours because, well, obviously they fear that there might be retaliatory rocket attacks from Gaza. What does this mean when he says we are prepared for any scenario? If they have to go into shelters, that really doesn't mean to be prepared for a scenario. It just means running away from it.
Well, I think that's another indication, frankly, of the precarious state of the Zionist entity and the effectiveness of the resistance. We've seen and heard from very senior figures in the Zionist entity who have talked in terms of the regime and the whole Zionist edifice actually, you know, crumbling. You know, very senior figures, former prime minister have said that, you know, they fear that the Zionist project could end before the end of this decade. So I think, you know, the brave talk from Netanyahu, but, I mean, the reality is that, you know, the tide of history is against them. The effectiveness of the resistance is growing. International opinion is increasingly critical of the Zionist regime. And I think that, you know, the writing is on the wall, frankly, for a substantial change and the, you know, the fortunes of the settler colony there is very much in doubt now. And, you know, what we need now, of course, though, is to push our politicians in the West to actually, you know, recognize that they are supporting the last brutal apartheid regime on the globe. And, you know, we know that there was a huge opposition around the whole of the world in opposition to the apartheid regime in South Africa. And that was, you know, in the end supported by Western countries who previously fallen in line and supported the South African regime. And I think, you know, given the strength of public opinion in all Western countries now is moving in favor of the Palestinian cause and Palestinian liberation, will force the politicians to change their tune and to actually recognize that they, you know, they need to be supporting a change in the whole situation there, which is completely untenable and has been going on now, as we know, for 75 years. Completely appalling. And, you know, we've got to keep the pressure up. That pressure is happening on the ground in Palestine, of course, but we need to be doing what we can outside of Palestine to continue to support the resistance there.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, these strikes in Gaza, where does this leave Egypt as a country that has been trying to mediate? You just brought up the name of Egypt, and you did mention that negotiations were supposed to be underway before this happened. So where does that leave a country like Egypt, who's trying to solve the issue through diplomatic means? Then you see such kind of reaction. Israel, you have a long list of UN resolutions that are being neglected by the Israeli regime, not to mention that most of the actions by this regime are against the international law and international conventions.
Well, clearly the Egyptian government had made a statement condemning this assassination. We know that the Egyptian negotiators were really upset and sent a stern response to the Zionists. They know that they have been put in a really bad situation now. The groups in Gaza now can refuse the negotiation efforts of Egypt. Since the morning, the Egyptian government has been trying to outreach to listen to Islamic Jihad, clearly to maybe ask them to not retaliate, but they have not been getting any responses from the listen to Islamic Jihad. And remember, Egypt, like the rest of the Arabic League, we're moving towards ending hostilities between Arabic states and realigning themselves together with Syria and having a separate foreign policy, as we see the Saudis are attempting to do that too, from the United States and Israel. And already Egypt is in the heat right now with the manufactured war in Sudan that the Israelis and the Americans instigated to make sure that even if Egypt at one point decides to have a sovereign foreign policy, that it will not be able to deliver on it, having a ring of fire spanning from Libya to Sudan, cutting it from its surrounding and making its economy suffer with millions of refugees coming from Sudan.
Okay, so, of course, the regional developments are also very important in considering the situation in Sudan as well. We will discuss that later. But meanwhile, Mr. Williamson, do you think that Israel has left any room for diplomacy with its actions? Or have we reached that point of no return where it is now proven to any observer that once and for all that the only way to fight against Israel is the resistance of the Palestinian factions, and there is actually no room for diplomacy left?
Well, I think that's been the case for a good number of years now. I mean, the Israeli regime has always negotiated in bad faith. We saw that with the Oslo Accords. The reality is they were never interested in self-determination for the Palestinian people. But the tide, as I say, is turning. And, the resistance is becoming more effective. The BDS campaign is ratcheting up. We've seen now the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran brokered by China. China is now a much bigger player on the international diplomatic scene, as it were, taking the place, frankly, of the United States of America, which, historically has always been supportive of the Zionist entity and continues to be so, bankrolling them to the tune of over $4 billion every single year. But the U.S.'s influence on the international scene is certainly waning. There is a new world order developing. We're seeing different powers coming together, you know, the link between China and Russia and Iran and other major players coming together in the BRICS, as it's known. And, you know, this is, I think, a very significant development, which can only augur well, I think, for the future in terms of a multipolar world. And we're moving away very rapidly from the unipolar world. I think the unipolar world is gone anyway. Now we're already in that multipolar world with, as I've already mentioned, the influence of China now. And the interesting thing is, you know, China approaches its kind of its foreign policy developments and the way in which it conducts itself on the international stage, does it in a way to try and, you know, bring about peace and to try and, as it were, mutually develop nations rather than the sort of gunboat diplomacy that we've seen from the likes of the United States of America and the United Kingdom and others in the Western world. And things are definitely changing, in my opinion. But as far as diplomacy is concerned with the Zionist entity, I think, you know, they've never negotiated in good faith. And I think they need to be forced, frankly, now to bring about the change. And that's, I think, you know, that's already happening, as we've already said, with the resistance on the ground and pressure building from outside as well.
So, Mr. Maruf, you just heard Mr. Williamson's analysis of the recent developments as far as the political equations of the region is concerned. And, of course, with China playing a more important role in the region. And how do you see the situation of Israel in the near future, maybe in the next 10 years?
Well, hopefully it will not be in existence in 10 years. It's clear that we are at the beginning of its collapse, and that comes, of course, coupled with the collapse of American hegemony and imperialism. Remember, I just want to put this out here. I don't think any pressure will change the minds of the leadership in the West about the Zionist colony. And that is because if the Zionist colony collapses, then the Western Empire will not be able to project its power over Asia and Africa and control the trade routes that are important there. It will be actually an acceleration of collapse of American imperialism. And this is why somebody like President Biden years ago said that if there was no Israel that was created by the Zionist movement, that the United States would have created it itself. So given those realities, we must understand that the only way to liberate Palestine is through direct confrontation with the Zionists and collapse of it under the pressure of resistance. There's nobody that's going to come to save the Palestinians, and there will be no Western negotiators to bring down the Zionists from the tree. This will be a battle to the end, and this is very important to understand, because if the Zionists were rational, or the imperialists were rational in terms of this issue, then we wouldn't see actions like we saw today. The clearer and closer we are to the liberation of Palestine, the more and higher possibility there will be of irrational actions by the Zionist colony and its backers, and as we see that happen today.
And, of course, let's not forget that Israel has been raiding the flashpoint city of Nablus, or the raids on Ariha, other parts of the occupied West Bank. So, Mr. Williamson, why is Israel attacking these parts of the occupied West Bank as well? Is it trying to deviate attention from its internal affairs?
Well, I think certainly that is part of the reason, I'm sure it is. But also, of course, that, you know, they want to try and crush the resistance, but it's a forlorn proposition. I don't think they're capable of doing that. And, you know, we've seen how the resistance pushed back the Israeli ground forces a couple of years ago when they were seeking to another incursion into Gaza, and, you know, the resort to these brutal air raids. But, you know, I do think that external pressure does have a part to play. Of course, in the end, Palestinian liberation will be delivered by the resistance on the ground. But I think external pressure can play a part. And of course, the imperialists who hold sway across the West at the moment are determined to, you know, maintain that position for the reasons that Marouf outlined. And we saw what happened when, for example, Jeremy Corbyn, who the leader of the opposition, the Labour opposition Labour Party in Britain, was within a hair's breadth of becoming the Prime Minister. Massive effort was put into destroying him and destroying his supporters. And, you know, that whole Corbyn legacy now has been utterly destroyed now within the British Labour Party. The Labour Party is nothing like it was under Jeremy Corbyn's tenure, because Jeremy did threaten that world order. He was somebody who was very supportive of the Palestinian cause and had been for decades and has spoken out numerous times in the Houses of Parliament in Britain. He was also in favour of peace on the world stage. He appointed a Minister for Peace and Disarmament, and, you know, we'd have had the prospect of Britain being a permanent member of the UN Security Council, promoting peace and disarmament around the world rather than war and arms sales. And that was unconscionable. Even Mike Pompeo, you know, the Secretary of State in the US, said words to the effect that, you know, they would not allow Corbyn to become Prime Minister. So there was certainly external interference there. So yes, of course the imperialists will do whatever they can, but the pressure is growing from the populace, as it were. And, you know, and these politicians are subject to election in the so-called Western democracies, and there is every prospect. I know that the Corbyn project was destroyed, but, you know, those people that were inspired by that haven't gone away. And so there is the prospect, I think, of getting new politicians elected to bring about the sort of revolution that, you know, we were hoping for under Jeremy Corbyn. And that's been replicated, you know, right across Europe and indeed in the United States of America as well. So I'm not, you know, totally pessimistic about the role of external pressure. I think it has a role to play and can actually help to hasten the demise of the Zionist entity. But look, as I've already said, you know, when you've got people like Naftali Bennett, the former Prime Minister of Israel, talking about, you know, the precarious nature of the Zionist entity, and other senior figures, you know, predicting former Prime Minister Barak talking about, you know, being ended within 10 years. I mean, they see the writing on the wall, it seems to me. So, you know, we need to obviously support the resistance wherever we can, and those of us who, you know, are not in Palestine, continue to put pressure on the policymakers to do whatever we can to, you know, up that and increase that pressure, that external pressure. Because that did, let's remember, play a part, that external pressure did play a part in actually bringing down the apartheid regime in South Africa. So, you know, we shouldn't be totally pessimistic about that, but we need to be realistic, I think, as Marouf has set out, but not actually give up on putting pressure, external pressure, to hasten that demise of the Zionist entity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chris Williamson, host of Palestine Declassified, joining us live from Derby in the UK, and also Laith Marouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thanks for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight and sharing your thoughts and views with us. That brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived under the wing of his father, the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, for a relatively short period that was not more than 7 years. However, at this young and tender age, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam displayed intelligence and talents that truly astonished the minds of great thinkers. And like his father, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had been impressed with the greatest of virtues and the highest of morals, the most profound of knowledge and wisdom, and his eternal values became as torches of guidance and awakening in the whole of the Islamic society.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly at your service talking about the beautiful dialogues and the conversations of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the 12 divinely appointed imams from the progeny of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. We find, dear friends, that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, who, as you know, was the son of the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. The era of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was witnessing a relative decline in the moral and ethical value system of the Muslims. And so in this kind of an environment, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam tried his best to revive and reconstruct and reform this moral and ethical decline which was being witnessed by the Muslims. Now, as we have said in some of our programs, this moral and ethical decline was partly due to the fact that the divinely appointed imams, who were the pillars of the religion, were cast aside.